When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The FT.
Welcome back to Banking Weekly. I'm Patrick Jenkins. This week we'll be looking at the ructions at HSBC following the announcement last week that Chief Executive Michael Gagan as well as Chairman Stephen Green would be leaving the bank. After that we'll turn our attention to Britain's Independent Banking Commission. How far can it go in reforming the sector? We'll then hear from Justin Baer in our New York office in Stateside, our new feature from the US. And finally, UniCredit. After the struggles in the boardroom there, who will take over from Alessandro Profumo? Joining me in the studio today is Miles Johnson, our investment correspondent.
Hello.
So let's start off with HSBC. It trickled out rather slowly and maybe rather more quickly than HSBC would have liked, but by Friday they'd come out and confirmed that Michael Gagan as chief executive would be leaving the bank, as well as Stephen Green, the chairman. So we've got two new bosses there. Stuart Gulliver coming in as chief executive as of the end of the year, alongside Douglas Flint as chairman. Miles, you've been talking to investors about this. What's the feeling out there?
Well, they're slightly shell-shocked in some ways. I mean, I think the way this information came out first sort of staggered, and then in this sort of rather large sort of dramatic announcement, I think, you know, there was a bit of confusion as to what was actually going on at the bank. But from the investors I've spoken to, they actually seem relatively happy with the outcome.
So the individuals, they've got no problem with. I think Douglas Flint, as finance director, has done a great job, and he's probably very comforting as a potential chairman.
Yes. I think everyone seems to be pretty content with Flint. He seems like a sort of safe pair of hands. I think the question actually hangs over Stuart Gulliver. Mm-hmm. One leading institutional investor described to me Mr. Gulliver as being a sort of unknown quantity at the moment. His lack of retail banking experience is seen as potentially being a bit of a gamble on the part of the bank. And
so Mr. Gulliver's been, I think, been at the bank for 30 years. He's the head of the investment bank at the moment. But I guess the bank would point to his experience in certain overseas areas, covering lots of different areas, not just core investment banking. So it'll be, and since January, he's had these additional responsibilities for the whole of kind of universal banking across Europe, Middle East and Asia. But as you say, investors are not necessarily comforted by 9 months of experience
yes.
to get the top job.
But then there is also, you know, one investor made the argument to me that HSBC is such a large organisation that the responsibility doesn't necessarily rest upon, you know, one individual, even if they are as key as the chief executive, and that he will clearly have huge sort of resources at his disposal and a very experienced team, which will be able to sort of guide him through any transition period. So I think there's a degree of sort of uncertainty amongst investors, but they are largely happy. I think they are certainly seem to be happier than if Gagan had sort of got what he wanted,
which was to go up to be the chairman himself.
Now
it does seem extraordinary. I mean, it chimes with really with what you're saying, but for any normal company or bank to lose a chairman, a chief executive, a finance director all at the same time, you'd have thought that would have huge ructions. But I think HSBC's share price fell something like 0.35% on rose 0.35% on Friday, but it was basically flat, which is extraordinary when you consider the level of disruption that potentially could be caused. But that, you know, chimes with your point that no one really thinks that a bank of this magnitude and, you know, super tanker like HSBC will really be disrupted by three individuals.
Yes. I think that's certainly what I'm hearing. And I mean, you know, investors have compared it to, for example, Barclays, where they've said, you know, compared to the role of someone like Bob Diamond, you know, his prominence and importance within Barclays differs quite significantly to the roles in HSBC.
Well, I suppose he built up an investment bank from scratch and proved that he was a big player in the sense that he could make a real difference to the bottom line. But yeah, we'll certainly watch that story closely going forward. It's going to be a few more months before, well, the end of the year, before the handovers actually happen. Stephen Green goes off to be trade minister in the UK government. Mr. Gagan goes off to do we don't know what outside the bank after 37 years. He said he didn't know what he wanted to do. He just wanted to be entrepreneurial, he said on Friday.
There we go.
So we'll see what happens there. Let's move on now to the Banking Commission. Now, on Friday, also, it was a very busy day on Friday, we had the Commission on Banking, which is the government-appointed commission headed by Sir John Vickers. It came back with its issues paper after considering for the summer what it wanted to do or how it wanted to go about its task of examining the competition on the high street in banking, but also the stability of the banking system in general. It came back with this issues paper in which it outlined really the options open to it. You've had a look, Miles, at the report which came out on Friday. What do you think about the terms of reference that's basically outlined there?
Well, it's interesting you have these sort of two extremes, I suppose, of one would be complete inaction and leaving everything as it was, and the other would be, you know, the full separation of retail banking from investment banking activities in British banks. And I think the interesting part about that is really if there is the political will to enact that sort of large scale change, if the Banking Commission actually decides that is the best course of action. So, you know, we'll see. I could see it being quite problematic.
Yeah, potentially. I guess that's right. Although the Commission, while it's independent in name, it does have the, and indeed all five members are, you know, non-affiliated to the government in any way, but it does have a secretariat which is draws its members from, in part at least, from the Treasury. So I'm sure word will get back to
be plugged in
to the politicians of what direction it's going in as it moves ahead. I mean, the other potential conflict of interest really is around the what happens to the government-owned banks. So, you know, the government still has 70% shareholding in RBS and 41% of Lloyds. Both of these banks, or the value of those shareholdings, could be hit quite badly, potentially, by an extreme Banking Commission decision.
So UKFI folk might not be best pleased if they sort of demolish the value of RBS. Yes,
no, quite. So, you know, RBS might have to split into two and Lloyds might have to sell a chunk of its retail bank. But as you say, I think the kind of considerations there are so delicate that it feels like the way the wind is blowing is that when we were presented with this whole spectrum of things that could be done, it feels like it's going to end up somewhere in the middle. So maybe along the lines of, for example, on the universal bank side, something like what the US has chosen to do in terms of the Dodd-Frank legislation, which limits proprietary trading, for example.
It's interesting, obviously, that, you know, the UK government have intimate sort of interactions with RBS and Lloyds, but with Santander, how does that work? I mean, would they be able to sort of just lay down the law to Santander in the same way they could to...
I think it's less of an issue for Santander because everyone believes really that the focus on high street competition is really going to be an issue for Lloyds, and probably Lloyds alone, in the sense that they have, you know, a 30% share of the current account market, for example. So it probably is to the benefit of the other players in the market, including Santander, which is, you know, admittedly a fairly dominant presence, but it's only the number five in the market, and therefore, you know, if Lloyds is told that it can't compete in the current account market anymore, then a bank like Santander would benefit. It's not really affected because it not being a universal bank, just really a retail bank largely anyway.
I see.
So it doesn't get hit by the other stuff. But no, I think it could be, in principle, what the Banking Commission is looking at would affect any bank regardless of ownership, because I suspect they would pass legislation necessary to enact it. So that's another interesting issue to watch, but I think it'll probably go off the radar now, at least until March next year, or largely until March next year, when we get the interim report back, which is where the Commission will narrow down its expectations of what its final recommendation should be to maybe, you know, two or three options. One thing to look out for in the interim, though, is that the Commission's planning to stage a whole load of public debates, question time style debates,
at
which the general public will have their chance to voice their opinions. We should make sure we go along to those.
Well. Yes, sounds fun.
Let's move on now to our new regular feature, Stateside. This week, Justin Baer brings us the news from the banking sector in the US. Over to you, Justin.
Thanks very much, Patrick. This week caps the end of another lackluster quarter for many financial services firms, yet another sign that trading activity remains weak. Many banks, who are still dependent heavily on their trading desks for revenue, had been counting on a pickup in market activity in September. That rally never materialized. Those fears were stoked again on Wednesday when Jefferies, an independent securities firm, reported on a call with analysts that trading activity had been quote-unquote painfully slow during the period. Indeed, the lack of volume and volatility has prompted a number of analysts to slash their earnings forecasts for the big banks. Expect more to come once the quarter officially ends on September 30th. We'll find out soon enough how accurate those forecasts will be. All of the big U.S. banks are slated to report results by late October. It's also worth noting that the new Oliver Stone film, Wall Street Money Never Sleeps, opened this month. The original movie captured the imaginations of a generation of would-be traders and bankers and added a veneer of glamour to the industry. It'll be fun to see how the generation of Wall Street folks, now many of whom are veterans, view Stone's latest take on the industry and on the crisis that nearly destroyed it. But in some ways, their views cannot be as interesting as those of the young people toiling away in business school or in math class. Maybe several years before we know if the sequel was as powerful of a recruiting tool as the original. Back to you, Patrick, in London.
So, Miles, what do you think of the new Wall Street movie?
Well, I look forward to seeing it. I mean, I saw an article today in the FT actually was talking about the influence Wall Street had had on attracting people into banking back in the 80s, which I found slightly strange, actually, because having seen Wall Street, I can't really see how it would...
What's attractive about Michael Douglas?
Well, exactly. I can't really see how it would really make, you know, youngsters want to go into that industry. But it's interesting. I mean, you know, the new Wall Street film, there was an article in The Economist which talked about how Oliver Stone had originally wanted to focus on nefarious hedge funds, sort of, you know, driving the world economy into collapse, but instead changed his focus to an investment bank, which according to The Economist has quite a lot of similarities of a certain large US firm which occasionally gets in trouble with regulators. So we'll see how they react to that.
Indeed. Finally, let's move on to talk about UniCredit. This is another bank like HSBC with a leadership problem, albeit HSBC's is resolved. UniCredit's isn't. Rachel Sanderson is on the line in Milan now. So, Rachel, what's the latest on the UniCredit saga?
What we're expecting now, Patrick, is that we're going to get, with every possibility, an announcement about the new management lineup on Thursday when UniCredit is holding a board meeting in Warsaw. This is, of course, a bank that is present in 22 countries, although it has an Italian base with a strong presence in Eastern Europe and Central Europe. So what we're looking at the moment, in my understanding, is there has been some discussions, some sort of seesawing between the board members about who they're going to pick. There are two sides of the argument. One, some of the board members would like to appoint someone of international standing, and that person that they want most of all seems to be Andrea Orcel, who is the executive chairman of Global Banking and Markets at Bank of America Merrill Lynch. And then on the other side, there are those who would prefer to appoint an internal candidate, and that's most likely to be one of the four managing directors that are currently within UniCredit.
And what about, it's Dieter Rampel, the chairman, that's likely to have the final say on this, I guess. Is he swinging one way or the other?
The sense that I get at the moment is that possibly Mr. Rampel is swinging towards an eternal candidate. The reason being, from sources I've spoken to, is that he is looking for possibly wanting to, as it were, have someone who will follow the line of Alessandro Profumo, the chief executive, who left very dramatically last Tuesday after an overwhelming vote of no confidence from the board.
Right, and what would that mean in terms of timescale? I guess it would mean someone could take over far sooner rather than leaving things up in the air for the rest of the year.
No, I think I would imagine that would be entirely the case. You have an internal candidate, you have a board meeting on Thursday, where we are expecting quite possibly for the top management, new top management to be announced, and one would imagine that person could start immediately.
Is there any sense for what shareholders think of this?
What you have, I'll tell you that the sort of main foreign shareholder beyond Libya, this is, BlackRock, have kept very quiet about this. I've been in touch with them and they are refusing to comment on the situation. So with the Libyans keeping very quiet about this, who of course are the largest shareholder between the Libyan Central Bank and the Libyan Investment Authority and UniCredit, with a stake about 7.5%, I suppose understandably they are keeping particularly quiet about this, given that their increase of their shareholding in UniCredit was one of the reasons that Alessandro Profumo ended up exiting the firm at such speed, because the board said that he had not kept them sufficiently informed about the Libyans increasing their stake. So the position at the moment is that we haven't really got a clear picture of what's going on amongst those shareholders. What we do know is that the foundations, the Italian banking foundations, from my understanding, are favouring the idea of a big international figure taking over at the bank. But as we said, that still hasn't been decided yet.
Now, the foundations are the organisations which control the balance of power, really, in UniCredit. Their ownership came as a legacy of UniCredit's previous life as a kind of succession of savings banks around the country. Is that right?
I don't know if they control the balance of power. What we've seen in the bank is that the Italian banking foundations are powerful figures and voices within the governance of UniCredit. They do date from the very beginnings of the bank. You have which UniCredit has in its base, the Bank of Verona, the Bank of Sicily, the Bank of Rome, and the foundations that are directly related to these territories do still continue to have a say in the board. What we have seen with Alessandro Profumo is that he, in internationalizing the bank, on some level upset the foundations, who felt that he was not paying sufficient attention to their needs, and in particular to producing dividends, for example, and paying out dividends, that those foundations wanted those funds in order to undertake projects within their territories of Italy. So they are certainly a section of the shareholder base that any new and the new chief executive will need to pay attention to.
And just one final thought on, you said the lead candidate there is Andrea Orcel from Bank of America Merrill Lynch. He's one of the best known bankers in Europe, certainly. I think, was also an advisor to UniCredit, or has been historically. How strong is the desire to get him on board, and why would that be?
I think the situation is, just to clarify, that he is, as it were, in terms of if the bank chooses an international candidate rather than an internal candidate, he definitely seems to be the top choice. The reason why the bank would want to get him on board, I was just speaking to someone involved in this a moment ago who is very much in favour of him. They said this would send out an excellent message to the market, mm-hmm. If this came to pass, because it would be seen that, you know, he's a very strong, very highly regarded international figure. He knows UniCredit intimately, having worked alongside Profumo at the bank for, I mean, all of the 50 or the last sort of 15 years, undertaken major deals for Capitalia, the taker of Capitalia by UniCredit. He also, of course, has an intimate knowledge of the investment banking business, which is an area that some, let's say, members of the board of UniCredit feel is something that the new CEO will need to concentrate on,
yes,
in order to build it up.
Well, we'll watch very closely over the next few days, and particularly on Thursday, when, Rachel, you think the decision could come on this. Thanks very much for joining us. That's sadly all we have time for today. All that's left for me to do is to thank Miles in the studio, Rachel Milan, and Justin Baer in New York. Banking Weekly was produced by Rob Minto. Until next week, goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Sometimes the transition to fall and winter feels like experiencing every season on the same day. The shoes in the Allbirds Mizzle collection were made for misty morning walks, surprise snow days, and anything a trip to the dog park might bring. The whole collection brings together water-repellent technology and classic style, so you can stay warm, dry, and comfy during your everyday adventures. Check off your errands with the Wool Runner Mizzle. Dash through cold and wet weather with the Wool Dasher Mizzle. Or upgrade to next-level protection with the Wool Runner-Up Mizzle Plus. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with your purchase. ALLBIRDS.com, code FRESHSOCKS.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.